You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 19th of August, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. It's been an exciting week. How are you doing?
I'm very happy to report that my cat, Stanley Jr., has been completely debriefed and taken out of his former employ at MI6. He is now on our side. I thought maybe he'd be approached by FSB, but apparently no one else wants him. He wasn't a very good agent anyway.
He's going to be keeping quiet now, is he? He's going to be keeping quiet and not jumping around on your keyboard?
Not messing around with wires or anything else. He could be like Matt Helm, a double agent, but I don't think he's that smart. So this is a great victory for our people.
It certainly is, and it seems there was a rather astonishing victory for the Taliban in Afghanistan at the weekend. They just walked in, and within 72 hours, all the American put in place government had laid down their weapons, the army had laid down their weapons, and they all went to the side of the Taliban. I mean, it was just astonishing to see, and I watched the press meeting that they gave, and I was quite emotional at that, to hear them talking so lovingly about their Afghan brethren and talking about the youth and wanting people to stay there. And what they were talking about made a lot of sense to me, and they seemed pretty good people. I know they've done some bad things in the past, blowing up the Bamiyan Buddhas for a start. I mean, that was a world heritage, but then I guess it's their country. They can do what they want. I mean, these guys are ethno-nationalists. They've got no plans to do anything to the countries outside of Afghanistan, and they should really be allowed to do whatever they want. And if they don't want gay pride flags and Holocaust museums in their country, then they shouldn't be forced to have them. And it was within a month of that gay pride flag being hoisted above the Kabul embassy that they went in and liberated Afghanistan. And I think that might have been something to do with it. And Matt, we've talked about the Taliban before, and you've made quite a few podcasts on them, and you've written a book on them, and you've also written papers on them. And you predicted this last year, didn't you?
Yes, I did. My book is on the American failures in the Islamic world, and Afghanistan takes a huge chunk of it. Yes, I was the first to start talking about these guys as a ethno-national force that's legitimately popular. The condition of Afghanistan before the Taliban took over was inhuman. Drugs, drug lords, oligarchs, no law, no constitution, no state. And they had to be very harsh in creating some kind of thing. You are talking about decades of nonstop warfare. So all of this, I knew this Afghan government was a puppet government. They had no support. You had massive defections from their ranks. I have American military commanders making fun of this army. They're mostly drug addicts. They're kicked out of their villages. They have nowhere else to go. They can't fight. They don't want to fight. They usually start shooting at hallucinations because they're so bad off. But one of my favorite stories here, and we talked about it on this show, back in 2010, there was an imposter claiming to be a Taliban commander. And he was in negotiations with the U.S. for weeks. He was getting money. The analysts were discussing his position. The guy was a fake. They had no idea who he was. That shows you, after that was 2010, 10 years of engagement in Afghanistan, the U.S. had no idea who these people are. And nothing has changed. Any newspaper report, you have the Taliban, it could be anybody. That's how ignorant the American regime is. There, that they could talk with fakes and have no idea. He was supposed to be second in command. And that had no idea. They have no idea who's who or who does what. Anyone can wear a robe and start shooting people that can claim it's Taliban. Taliban does wear uniforms, by the way. But they can do what they please, and there's no way for anyone to know. Talk about Johnson's Law. But that story is proof that the U.S. has no idea what's happening there.
Well, I think they might have mentioned something about that. They said that there were people that were impersonating the Taliban, and they deliberately didn't want there to be any fighting because they didn't want there to be any looting. They didn't want Kabul to get damaged in any way. And they were concerned that these other groups that pretend to be Taliban and cause lots of upset might start causing trouble. So maybe that fits in there, Matt. Well, we've got some quotes from your books here, and we've also got a quote about Keir Starmer that comes from RT. UK Labour Party leader Keir Starmer argued in Parliament on Wednesday that the invasion of Afghanistan brought stability to the region and reduced the threat of terrorism in the West days after the Taliban took over Kabul. During a House of Commons debate over the withdrawal of US and UK troops from Afghanistan this week, which led to the Taliban quickly taking over the country, Prime Minister Boris Johnson declared that the UK would judge the new regime on the choices it makes and by its actions rather than its words. Starmer, meanwhile, condemned the disastrous week and staggering complacency from our government about the Taliban threat, before attempting to argue that the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks was meaningful and worthwhile. Telling British soldiers and their families that your sacrifice was not in vain, Starmer said the invasion brought stability, reduced the terrorist threat, and enabled progress. We are all proud of what you did, the Labour Party leader continued, acknowledging that many returned with life-changing injuries, while hundreds more didn't return at all, before adding, your sacrifice deserves better than this, and so do the Afghan people. During the nearly 20-year war in Afghanistan, 47,245 Afghan civilians died, along with 66,000 members of the Afghan military and police, 3,846 US contractors, nearly 2,500 US soldiers, 457 British military personnel, 444 aid workers, and 72 journalists. And on top of that, trillions of dollars were spent by the US on this war, while the UK government is estimated to have spent between £22 billion and £40 billion, which is between $30 and $55 billion. In recent days, news outlets and analysts have identified the Taliban as the greatest beneficiary of the money spent by the US on Afghanistan, noting that not only did the Taliban manage to take Kabul in a matter of hours, but the organisation also captured billions of dollars worth of weaponry, ammunition, helicopters, ground vehicles, and even drones that were left behind by departing troops. So all of those resources that went in there eventually ended up in the Taliban's hands anyway, and they appear to have had some weapons training now. I guess some of them must have joined up with the Afghan army to get the training, so they knew how to use the weapons, and they've got all the money. But of course, what are they going to do with all that wealth? I mean, they renounce wealth, don't they? They renounce materialism. So I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see if all that wealth really does get invested in the country now. What do you make of all of this and what Keir Starmer had to say, Matt?
Well, it's hard not to laugh, so I usually don't bother. I've proven elsewhere that these casualty statistics are at least five times greater. There's a lot of different ways that they minimize those. So much of the money spent is off budget, so there's really no record of it. Taking the country in a matter of hours, which of course I predicted very easily, proves the popularity of the Taliban. Their claim to fame, of course, is rebuilding the economy before 2001, which they did with the help of Pakistan. They broke the backs of the opium trade, which was a terrorist organization throughout. The only place that was restored was places under American occupation. They broke the back of the oligarchy, and they rebuilt the family. None of this stuff existed after the Soviet war and, you know, the chaos that followed up until 9/11. The entire concept of the invasion, the Taliban and Osama bin Laden were opponents. Osama condemned the Taliban. The Taliban then condemned 9/11. They didn't say he did it. Of course, he didn't. But they condemned that because innocent people, including Muslims, were killed here. They've been very strict in their adherence to the treaty when the U.S. surrendered, but the U.S. has not been. There's been nothing but chaos. The minute the U.S. invaded, all the progress the Taliban put out collapsed, and the place was back now in fifth world level. Now the Taliban is going to have to rebuild yet again, and the U.S. is going to do everything it can to freeze those assets and destroy it and make sure that they don't prove themselves to be extremely extremely adept. But they've done it before. Before 2001, they did an excellent job. It was a Pakistan-Afghan alliance, and it did very well. I'm not sure where ISIS now is going to get its money without the U.S. present there, but I'm sure the Israelis will find another way.
Well, let's have a look at some of what they did last time then. This is a quote from one of your books. I believe it's The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, The Failure of Western Engagement in the Middle East. Today, after almost two decades of American propaganda warfare, the Taliban, or the groups the regime thinks are Taliban, are thriving. The US Air Force enjoys posting videos of its overpriced planes destroying Taliban drug labs, except that drugs are punishable by death under Taliban law. No one can say differently, so calling anyone you want to kill then becomes Taliban. It's the new American way of war, it's the way of the coward. The reason they cannot win and why the US is in a permanent state of defeat is that the Taliban are popular. The US is not. The Kabul money markets responded positively during the first weeks of the Taliban rule, but the Afghani soon fell in value. They imposed a 50% tax on any company operating in the country, and those who failed to pay were attacked. In the absence of institutions, this was an unfortunate necessity. Now, I'm assuming that that's talking about 50% tax on any foreign company that was operating in the country. And why did the Afghani soon fall in value? And what are your predictions for what's going to happen to the economy now that the Taliban are back?
Well, thank God the Afghan economy doesn't have much to do with the U.S. They're going to have to break old ties with a lot of foreign suppliers that were building up the American presence there. They're going to have to go back to possibly support with Pakistan, which had been the case before. Russia may be involved, and there's a little bit of a certain rivalry with Iran, but that can be overcome very quickly because the Taliban and Iran had problems. So, but I have no doubt that if the U.S. stays out, they centralize control, they bring back the old policies, they can rebuild everything that the U.S. destroyed. They're going to have to smash the poppy fields again. They're going to have to break the back of these militias created by the CIA that thrive on drug money. And I should say the other thing I forgot to mention that is the basis of Taliban popularity is that the child sex cults that the AMA, the Afghan National Army, was engaged in, they broke. And I have proof. I have American soldiers testifying that that these so-called Chai boys were a part of the secular culture in Kabul, and that that so-called old tradition was smashed by the Taliban. And that's a huge port. And they released a lot of these boys. It was an awful thing. I have testimony all over the place. These guys talking about this, and the U.S. was not allowed to interfere with it, which pissed off a lot of American soldiers. And the Taliban smashed all this. So these are excellent foundations for popularity. If they continue this, even though they've been decimated through war, they're just going to rebuild and continue where they left off in 2001.
It's very strange, isn't it? The American army goes over there and it's told not to interfere with the abuse of children and not to interfere with the poppy fields and both things that the Taliban had actually got rid of. Well, we've also got some other nationalist policies here. They also imposed a 6% import tax on anything brought into the country, and by 1998 had control of the major airports and border crossings, which allowed them to establish a monopoly on trade. By 2001, the per capita income of the 25 million population was under $200. As of 2007, the economy recovered with estimated foreign reserves of $3 billion and a 13% increase in economic growth. The Taliban delivered the goods. They were the legitimate government and certainly had every disincentive to irritate the US. Under the transit treaty between Afghanistan and Pakistan, a cross-border turnover of almost $3 billion was the result. Protecting this trade was the source of Taliban income. The Pakistani government trained, armed, and financed the Taliban to clear the southern roads across Afghanistan to the Central Asian republics of bandit gangs. This only increased their popularity. the Taliban had banned all forms of ostentation. In discussing a prohibition against men wearing gold and silk, for example, Yousef Karadawi in 2001 and other scholars included as justification, from the Quranic point of view, luxurious living leads to weakness among nations and to their eventual downfall. The existence of luxury is also an expression of social injustice, as only a few can afford luxurious items at the expense of the deprived masses of people. So you've got nationalism there and trying to strengthen the nation, and you've also got socialism there, who's concerned about social injustice. Are there any other instances of those two things being put together by the Taliban, Matt?
Yeah, when I talked about the resurrection of the economy, I'm talking about in Taliban areas, which is really the majority of the country. The U.S. controlled only the big cities for the most part. One of their important innovations is the Hawala system of banking. It's rejection of Western banking norms. It's transferred through money's transferred through informal webs. It's based on the honor system, which means you need a tight, very strong culture. They have to know each other. No paper exists. It's based on morality rather than power. It can operate in the absence of any kind of Western oversight. It offers a fast, convenient transfer of funds with very low commission costs. And you can't really bet on a currency like Soros does within such a system. This is one of the ways, and the World Bank, when the Taliban was ruling, refused to measure their economy. It's just a blank spot on their records. And it's because of practices like this. They don't understand. This banking practice had no usury on the honor system, and it worked. When you're rebuilding a war-torn country with minimal resources, you can't have, you know, oligarchs buying Mercedes. They realize that when resources are that rare and that hard to come by, you can't have one group of people monopolizing them. And the Taliban were strict on this. That wasn't the case when the Kabul government, the puppet government that just was overthrown, had women and they had boys and they had alcohol everywhere. They were financing ISIS. You know, they existed only because the U.S. supported them. The minute the U.S. pulled out, as I said, they fell apart. No one's going to die for this group of people. So they're the opposite of what the Taliban was. And the Taliban refused to negotiate with them because they knew that they had no support. But the Hawala banking system, this is one of the things the Taliban was able to develop that built the economy. And the Western oversight boards had no idea what was going on. And they're going to continue to do this. And they could do this even under conditions of warfare.
Well, you know, that's real diversity, isn't it? Having a completely different banking system to the West. And of course, the West doesn't want real diversity. The West wants everything to be globalized. Well, they also took an interest in morality. In areas controlled by the Taliban, all Western technological advances were destroyed. Moral rebuilding could not handle these Western distractions. These had been used to demoralize the people before. It was not the medium, but the message that caused such anger. Capital punishment was used frequently. Due to the loss of this growing market, Washington would not recognize the government. It remains curious how Washington turned on them as they banned the growth of Western media into Afghan society. The Taliban are not isolationists and have offered closer contacts with the rest of the world. These have largely been conditioned by the fact that there has been negative publicity about their implementation of Sharia law. Not recognizing that a strong hand is necessary to rebuild a war-torn society whose moral code had been life is cheap, the wealthy, comfortable NGOs issued virtue-signaling condemnations. The Taliban constitution was supplemented by the common law. This is local custom and is connected to Sharia law, of course. Anything that rejected it would be very unpopular. These include harsh measures against all forms of family violence, fornication, adultery, divorce and usury, and these would be popular in the country as it seeks to rebuild it. I mean, they are pretty strict here, Matt. What do you make of the hand chopping off and the women having to be covered up and the hangings and all that sort of thing? Did it work? Did it solve the problems? Did they no longer have a crime problem there? Did they no longer have a problem with divorce and adultery and all that sort of thing when they had these strict punishments?
This is the foundation of their popularity. This is why they could take over an entire country in a month. This is why they could continue to develop this tremendous esprit de corps and unity that they had and grow the economy. You're talking about a country that had been crushed under warfare for decades. Morality was gone. The family was gone. The only thing that people knew was the gun. The only option there to rebuild is to be very harsh. This is not a time for liberalism of any kind. And it did work. So many of these men were armed. They had experience in combat, drug gangs, everything else. They had to be extremely careful what they did. In the era of the warlords, just before the Taliban takeover, you do not want to be a woman. They were sex slaves to some of these guys. Protecting women, especially in banning, you know, American pornography, American high-tech developments, was, you know, again, it just empowered an oligarchy. This had nothing to do with the needs of the common peasantry. And this all comes from a paper, The American Military Humiliated, Afghanistan is a True Graveyard of Empires, I wrote in 2019. And this is how they rebuilt. It did work. And they were building some kind of relative prosperity before the American invasion of 2001.
Well, this is one of the things that I've noticed have been in the papers. They've been talking about the Taliban and taking sex slaves. And I thought, well, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, that's the sort of thing you hear ISIS doing with the Yazidi people and people that aren't Muslim. But they are all Muslim in Afghanistan. Why would they be taking sex slaves? And you highlight here that it wasn't so much the medium, but it was what was actually on the medium. So it's not really the technology. It was the Western ideas and idealism that was being pushed through the technology. Because I've noticed they I think they're on Twitter. So they're definitely using technology now. So it's not that they want to ban technology. It's just that they don't like the message that is put across on that. I've got another quote here from one of your papers, Inruentis Imperii, on the final victory of the Taliban in Afghanistan. This is from 2019. The Afghan puppet administration in the capital is considered a joke by almost everyone, including the Americans. This is why morale is non-existent and their few remaining soldiers fight for a monthly check and nothing else. So what is the record of the Kabul regime? In the meantime, surveys conducted by an international organ revealed that the heterogeneous stooge regime is completely failed and inefficient, and Afghanistan is facing one of the highest famine ratios, despite the huge amount of international funds provided over the years. John Sopko, the head of SIGAR, announced that the number of casualties of local mercenary armed forces have significantly increased, and the stooge admin in Kabul and the American masters have agreed not to reveal the real number of their casualties and losses from now on. On the other side, the power supply company in Kabul said that high-ranking stooge officials owe nearly 10 billion Afghanis, and they have not paid their electricity bills for years. No one is surprised. In areas it controls, the Taliban have smashed the drug trade and cleansed the area of armed warlords and various roving bands. In August of 2019, almost 1,000 government workers in Kabul joined the Taliban. Another 700 deserted to the Taliban in April. In fact, the administration in the capital city cannot count on the loyalty of any of its workers. The Kabul regime cannot be called a government because it is not independent. It can't control much of its territory, and it follows no law. Today, the Taliban control most of the country without help from foreign governments. This proves they are popular and have the support of the population. In 2019, NATO fully admitted the mission was a failure, and the US began negotiating with the Taliban and without the Kabul state. The US military openly state that the Afghan army raises money through the sale of children. Child molestation, called Baka Bazi locally, is part of the army culture there. British and American Marines have stated over and over again that child molestation is endemic. This is part of the reason the Taliban are so popular, and they have every right to be. They shoot child molesters and drug dealers while the US and the ANA welcome them, or at least tolerate them. The Taliban legislate the death penalty for this crime. The Kabul government uses chai boys on every base without exception, and those complaining or escaping are shot. The Afghan puppet state's military and police under US control are normally on various drugs and have no idea how to fight, according to US military authorities. Many American casualties come from drugged out ANA soldiers. They shoot blindly at random people due to hallucinations, both as a result of and a withdrawal from drugs. Most American advisors have given up on these characters. Heroin use is endemic, and they force local children to fill sandbags and do the unpleasant work that needs doing on their military bases. And these are the people that we're now being told, oh, we should be accepting these poor people as refugees. The ones that are fleeing from the Taliban, that we're told that, you know, we should be feeling sorry for them, welcoming them into our country. they're the ones that were getting involved in this institutionalized child abuse, the ones that were involved with the puppet government and the army here. Are they doing the same over there in America, Matt, calling for Afghan refugees to come into America?
Well, of course. Yeah, it's everywhere. Braced for this new explosion of refugees. I mean, they've been wars going on for a long time. I don't remember a massive refugee problem coming to America or Europe prior to the Syrian war. But yeah, I had one quote in there, the Stooge regime. That comes from the Taliban directly. They had an excellent website and very good English. And you guys ought to keep up with a lot from them. But yeah, I have, you know, citation after citation of British and American Marines talking about the sale of children. There is an excellent YouTube documentary on the army of Afghanistan, the puppet army, and how their advisor, the American advisors, have given up. They simply can't fight. The people who are flooding the airports right now are those from the cities that either worked for the Stooge government or had or families or soldiers or policemen or something like that. They're not poor people. And they realize that a lot of them are going to go on trial if they get captured, and they deserve to be. This isn't like Saigon in 75. You had an illegitimate North Vietnamese. No, this is a popular force. They're going to put these guys on trial at a maximum for these crimes. And what the American media is going to do, I'm not sure. But this is and how many Americans have been killed from these drugged out ANA soldiers? This is something Americans are talking about all the time. Not anymore. But, you know, when you Taliban comes in and starts shooting drug dealers, starts shooting the child molesters, rescuing kids, they're going to be really popular. And this is what they do. And then they rebuild the economy on top of it. I'm not saying that child molestation is a part of Afghan culture, but it is of the group of people who run the government there, used to run the government there. And these are the same people who are trying to escape Taliban justice.
What about the Taliban saying that they were going to be giving amnesty to anybody that had worked with the occupation government? They were going to give them amnesty. They were all Afghans, and they wanted to draw a line under it because, you know, I thought, well, that, you know, that's a very noble nationalist sentiment that's being expressed there. But you think that they are still going to be taking some of these people to court and trying them for their crimes?
Yeah, I mean, if they get pointed out as criminals, there's no question about it. I don't know if these people actually believe the Taliban. They're probably right. They don't really have the resources to round up, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. But specific individuals, I think there's no doubt about it. I don't think they just believe them. The Taliban wants to rebuild. He realizes people are deluded, American propaganda, drugs, whatever. They could reform them. But I doubt that the people crowded the airports right now actually believe it. And I think they have a guilty conscience.
Well, I should imagine it's if people have committed specific crimes, then they will be tried. But just for actually working with the foreign government, that's not a crime in itself, and you'll get an amnesty. So I should imagine that that's what they mean there. This is continuing from your paper here. The occupation forces in Afghanistan are supporting the drug trade, which brings between $120 and $194 billion of revenue to organized crime, intelligence agencies, and Western financial institutions. The proceeds of this lucrative multi-billion dollar contraband are deposited in Western banks. Almost the totality of revenues accrue to corporate interests and criminal syndicates outside of Afghanistan. The Golden Crescent drug trade, launched by the CIA in the early 80s, continues to be protected by US intelligence in liaison with NATO occupation forces and the British military. In recent developments, British occupation forces have promoted opium cultivation through paid radio advertisements. A radio message broadcast across the province assured local farmers that the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force would not interfere with poppy fields currently being harvested. Respected people of Helmand, the soldiers of ISAF and ANA do not destroy poppy fields, it said. They know that many people of Afghanistan have no choice but to grow poppy. ISAF and the ANA do not want to stop people from earning their livelihoods. And that's a quote from Chasadovsky, 2007. So what were they doing then? If they had to grow the poppy fields and the Taliban got rid of the poppy fields, what were they doing to actually make a living, Matt?
Well, they had several programs. I mean, they weren't starving. They had to substitute it with something that was actually necessary. We'll talk here in a second that, you know, the poppy field, the actual legitimate drugs, if there are any legitimate narcotics, that supply is long taken care of. So this is for illicit, this is for heroin. There's a million things that they could be growing that are needed in the country that can make money on. It was the drug lords that were forcing them to grow poppy in the first place. They didn't necessarily want to. So these people, so and all the Taliban did was point a gun to their head and say, you keep doing this, you're not going to exist anymore. They won their drug war in a couple weeks. But here you have advertisements beamed in saying, well, you know, do what you need to do. We're not going to interfere. It's a legitimate matter. At the same time, they're blaming the Taliban for supporting drugs, which is the most ridiculous form of projection and deflection I've ever come across.
Well, I did read that they have a rare metal in Afghanistan that is used for making batteries with, and they will be making a lot of money from that. So perhaps they can cross over to that. And I know they do use coal tar to synthesize a lot of the opiates from nowadays. And really, you know, I mean, why not just buy the legal opiate crop from Afghanistan so that there isn't any that can actually get out illicitly? You know, you don't have to make it from coal tar. As you say, we've got some opiate statistics here. There were 189,000 heroin users in the US in 2001, before the US NATO invasion of Afghanistan. By 2016, that number went up to 4.5 million, 2.5 million heroin addicts and 2 million casual users. Heroin deaths shot up from 1,779 in 2001 to 10,574 in 2014, as Afghan opium poppy fields metastasized from 7,600 hectares in 2001, when the US-NATO war in Afghanistan began, to 224,000 hectares in 2016, so it's gone up to 250,000. Ironically, the so-called US eradication operation in Afghanistan has cost an estimated $8.5 billion in American taxpayer funds since the US-NATO-Afghan war started in October 2001. That's another Chasudovsky citing there from Chasudovsky. There is no denying that the troops are little more than overpaid drug dealers. It is a common misconception that the US gets its heroin from Mexico. That figure only refers to the finished product. The poppies are from Afghanistan roughly 90% of the time. Mexico is the transit point. The UNODC states that about 60% of the poppy crop in Afghanistan is made into heroin, and the Marines admitted in an interview with Geraldo Rivera that they refused to destroy the opium trade because it would turn the population against them. And he also admitted that they had no idea who is the Taliban and who is merely Islamic. Matt, what are your final thoughts on all of this?
I guarantee you those numbers. Now, I'm quoting Chasudovsky, of course, is the founder of the of Global Research. It's one of my favorite websites. I guarantee you they're low. But the minute the U.S. invaded that country, reinstituted the poppy production, you had a massive, massive outflow of heroin into Europe, Russia, and the U.S. This is where 85% of the world's heroin comes from. The, you know, the Narcotic Control Board says that there is more than enough poppies being grown for legitimate uses, if there is such a thing. So overwhelmingly, this is for heroin. This is for illicit use. So there's no doubt about it. Now, about the turning the population against them, they were making some good money here. At least the Taliban had an alternative. You could grow other things. They were subsidized to grow other things. Here, you know, they simply refused. They refused not because the population would be angry at them. They refused because they were under orders. They were making a huge amount of money here. They were, you know, thugs supporting a massive drug distribution center and claiming Mexico is the source is nonsense. 85 to 90% of the world's heroin originates in Afghanistan, the rest from Southeast Asia. So this is the final end of the American empire, I think, the final humiliation, the final destruction. And let them talk, make up stories about them, you know, raping women for no reason and all this other stuff. But that's just a distraction from the reality. The narcotics crisis comes from the American invasion of Afghanistan.
I do think it's a sign of things to come. I think it's a sign of changes to come. I hope so. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.